My guest, Eleanor Smeal, former president of the National Organization for Women, is the author of the new book, Why and How Women Will Elect the Next President. It covers the development of the gender gap, women's political issues, organizing women, and getting out the vote. She also devotes chapters to women who want to run for office. Why and How Women Will Elect the Next President is published by Harper. Smeal was the president of NOW from 1977 to 1982. She's currently publishing a women's political bulletin that's called the Eleanor Smeal Report. Eleanor Smeal, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's great being here.
NOW never endorsed a political candidate before. I think this is the first presidential election. And I remember that NOW used to insist upon the importance of remaining politically neutral so that they wouldn't be sold out to any candidate or beholden to any particular party or person. Why was there...
It's usually the reverse, you know.
What?
When somebody endorses, you hope they're somewhat beholden to you, but go ahead.
Why did NOW decide to endorse a candidate now?
Well, the major reason is because of the unusual political climes that we're living in. Ronald Reagan has conducted an administration that is absolutely against women's rights. It is narrowing women's opportunities. And it's not rhetoric on our part. I mean, we wish it wasn't. But you essentially have an administration that is gutting enforcement of affirmative action. The various commissions and bodies that were intended to enforce civil rights and women's rights are now pretty much not only defending the status quo, but they're attacking the methods of remedying justices. So essentially we find that we're under full-fledged attack, not only incidentally in the area of breaking new ground or just frankly enforcing the law to end discrimination, but also in the area of budgeting and finance, where you're having the budget defund all kinds of programs affecting females. And, of course, you have a runaway military situation where we have a military buildup that's larger than Vietnam on the other side of the sheet. And at the same time, this is going on. Some basic fundamental rights, we believe, for women are under threat. For example, the right to choose in matters of birth control and abortion. So you're looking at a situation where you're going backwards on the economic front, you're going backwards on the front of new opportunity, and where you have really an unprecedented crisis and threats of your rights. So what we're saying is that we couldn't stay out, not in this day and age, and we have to enter in an area where we think that maybe we could help. At least we're not going to sit it out. We're going to do the best we can.
Was this very controversial within the National Organization for Women?
No, I think that because of the political times that we live in, it frankly would have been controversial if we did nothing.
Why of the people running in opposition to Reagan was Mondale chosen for the endorsement?
Well, he's chosen for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is his own record as a senator and as a public spokesperson has been solid on women's rights issues. But we don't judge solely on the basis of one issue for office as fundamental as the presidency. We feel that his record on civil rights has been commendable, that he has strong labor support, which, frankly, we view that we've been an ally with the labor movement. We believe in collective bargaining. And he is probably the most electable in that he's way out in front. And it seemed to us that in this day and age, as long as we had such a clear and present threat on one side, and he was strong on most of our issues, that we felt that the best thing we could do is help consolidate behind a person who could defeat what we consider a disaster for women.
When endorsing a candidate, do you think that you should look at their stand on, in this case, women's issues, or do you think that...
Oh, absolutely.
Or do you think that you have to look at the candidate as a whole as well?
Well, you got to do both. You got to look at the stance in particular. For example, if he was opposed to any major women's rights issue, we wouldn't be there. But you got to look at the stance vis-a-vis what you're particularly interested in, but then you have to look at the overall. For example, we're concerned with a somewhat of a hawk posture of a couple other candidates, or at least what we consider... more militaristic, where you have to be really interested in the totality, but we would not be true to our own constituency if we were not interested in our issue, too.
I believe that Jesse Jackson, before he declared for a candidate, was opposed to abortion in part because it mm-hmm. violates his religious point of view. And you were telling me that when or shortly after he announced that...
It was before he announced.
Before he announced, mm-hmm. he stated that although he might be personally opposed to it, that he thought it was important to maintain pluralism and that it's a right people should have. Do you think that that change was made because of pressure from
groups like Well, I don't think it's like so Nile? Much as pressure as a reality of the coalitions that make up a possible winning combination. Jesse is very, very much aware of human rights movements. He's very much aware of the women's movement and of the need to reach out and work in coalition. And I think he was quite aware of the fact that his allies would not only be pro-choice, but also if you are going to be a representing a political viewpoint that is inclusive and representing many different viewpoints, you really can't have a political dogma that it makes illegal other people's beliefs. So I think that he's quite right when he says, as a minister of one particular religious faith, I might advocate, you know, for members of that faith to do one thing. But as a public office holder, he thought and thinks that that one thing about laws is that we should not have a joining of church and state, but more religious freedom.
Pollsters who discuss the gender gap say that Reagan does not do as well with women mm-hmm. as he does with men. Do you think that he's trying to compensate for that in this new campaign?
Oh, I think that to a degree. But I think that how they're going to handle most things, as a matter of fact, is by a campaign strategy of super confidence that they're going to win, that he's the most popular president since Eisenhower. By the way, he is not. Eisenhower had 76% support by Gallup at this time. He only has about 54%. Carter had a like standing in the polls at the same time. So in reality, he's trying to paint a picture that he's invincible, he's going to win, and therefore it helps to demoralize his opponents and to, frankly, not motivate them to vote. And since he's a minority president, I mean, let's face it, in 1980 he was elected by 27% of the electorate. A lot of people forget that. Yeah, they forget that because of Anderson being in the race, Carter lost 17 states that he would have carried if Anderson hadn't been in the race. It would have been a much closer race even if Anderson hadn't been in there. But essentially, they need a small voter turnout. If blacks and women turn out heavily, this person will lose this election. It's a very, very close nip-and-tuck race. And I think what they want to do is make it look like, there's no problem, they're going to win, the economy's rosy, everything's delightful. But that is not reality, and I think that reality will catch up with them.
Eleanor Smeal is my guest, and she was the president of Now from 1977 to 1982. She's written a new book titled Why and How Women Will Elect the Next President. Well, there's all this talk about the gender gap now, which is the phrase that's been used to describe the difference between male and female voting patterns in America. Why do you think it's suddenly an issue? Do you think it's existed before but pollsters just noticed it, or do you think it's a new phenomenon?
Well, I think that it's been a phenomenon like most that came into being gradually. But it is now one that's determining elections. I mean, in 1982, Cuomo, who's the governor of New York, the governor of Michigan, the governor of Texas, were really elected by a majority of the females, while the majority of the males voted for their opponent. And it was the difference, in fact, more women cast the vote and the majority of females was larger, that elected them. So when you have a woman's vote out there that is large enough to determine the elections, now, obviously, you know, when you say this, people get this notion that I mean all women. Of course I don't. I'm talking now about the margin of victory. And when you have 55% of women voting for one candidate and maybe 52% of the men voting for another, you for sure the females are going to, you know, are going to win because we just are more numerous in the first place. But even if they were identical percentages, we would win. And frankly, even if we're slightly behind, we would win because we're casting just many more votes. So it's that margin of difference that we're talking about. And right now, Reagan has had about a 10% gender gap. In other words, on the average, women were only approving of him in the 40 percentile ranges, while men are approving of him in the 50 and 60 percentile ranges. So there is a gap there of nearly 10 points. If it's large, and if in fact enough women are disapproving, or he doesn't get even close to a plurality of women, I don't think there's any way he can get elected.
Do you think that the gap between men and women has to do specifically with women's issues? Do you think it's about stands on reproductive rights and the Equal Rights Amendment?
I think that figures into it. In fact, I think that women's rights issues is what triggered it. Because I think there is a general perception now that the Republicans are not as good on women, and you're voting against your self-interest if you vote for them. But I think that after that general perception, there are specific issues. Of course, ERA and abortion are among them, but so is unemployment, so is inflation, so is sending the troops to Lebanon. There's a lot of things, and I think the major underlining connecting link of all of the issues is the fact that women perceive them differently than men because their life experiences have been different. And frankly, sex discrimination has played a large role in them seeing it differently. And just to give you an example on unemployment, over the last 10 years, women have suffered from unemployment more than men. Right now in the so-called recovery, single heads of households, which are mainly females, still suffer from double-digit unemployment, while unemployment of white married males is quite low. So essentially, you are looking at a phenomena that is packing females much different than it is males. And which females also worry about is you can solve unemployment, they fear, by driving females out of the labor force. Men don't worry about that. And so essentially, we look at the solutions for unemployment differently. We think the government should be more active on the whole, that they should create more jobs, where men have a notion of Horatio Alger that they can pull themselves out by their own bootstraps.
You say that you think military spending is one of the women's
Absolutely.
Issues. Now, women aren't drafted. Well, actually, no, I mean, nobody's drafted now, but women do not serve in the same numbers
I think
that
the
men do. Why is military spending a women's issue?
Well, because I think that women look at this spending in this sector and say it's costing them jobs. They instinctively know that this is not something that they're going to benefit from. In fact, they're right, because for every increase of $1 billion in military spending, women lose 9,500 jobs. On the other hand, males have traditionally looked at increase of military spending as creating jobs, as being a creation of jobs in the heavy industry sectors where they work. Actually, they're wrong. Labor is not that intensified in the military sector, and in reality, $1 billion increase in military spending also costs men 500 jobs. It doesn't cost them as many as a woman, but it does cost them. Well, actually, though, I don't think men perceive that as much as women perceive that it costs them. Women are much more hostile to the concept. You take that, coupled with the fact that what has happened in our country is military increases in military spending have been coupled with, it's not necessary that they had to been, but that has been coupled with decreases in what they call social spending. Social spending, in my opinion, is survival spending, but it's the spending for the poor, the aged, Social Security, Medicare. I mean, it's the health care, it's the jobs and education training. It's the programs that females view as important from two important phenomena. One, they tend to be the trained workers in this area. They're the social workers, they're the teachers, they're the health care providers. And so essentially, they feel like this helps their jobs. But there's another part of it. They're also the majority of the recipients of these government programs. The elderly are primarily women. And the people who are on AFDC, or Aid to Dependent Children, are primarily females, et cetera. So essentially, you're hitting them from both ends, and women are seeing that this is costing them money, and men don't feel similarly because they're not affected as much.
Do you feel that now has pressured the Democrats to address issues that are especially important to women and to address them in such a way as to please women?
Well, I think that now has contributed in large measure to the process of making the Democrats more aware. I don't think that process is by any means over.
What is the process of getting a party to put your issues on their agenda?
Well, it's a lot of hard work. It begins really in a year in and day out fight of access to political leadership, to becoming part of that leadership, to making sure you're represented in the convention floors, to making sure that you're constituency is important to that leadership. It's not just, you know, there's no blueprint for something like this, but it's a lot of day in and day out hard work, plus, in fact, your ability to deliver. And I think that now has over the years, I mean, let's face it, one of the reasons there is a gender gap is the work of the women's movement and work of now, in which we made more and more millions of women actually aware of the fact they were being cheated, aware of the fact they were getting less pay, aware of the fact that these kinds of government budgets cost them more than cost men. So essentially, we are a part of the process that created the gender gap, which now is a political tool to making of a power. So, I mean, there's no easy way, but you have to have a constituency and you have to have the ability, in fact, to be heard.
There are, I believe, women's caucuses in the Democratic and Republican parties.
Absolutely.
Do you think that they're effective in bringing women's issues?
Well, they're part of it.
The floor.
They're important, and they're gaining more power as women get more power.
Do you see the women's caucuses as necessarily being feminist?
Not necessarily, no, but definitely leaning there. You know, the funny thing about women is if you scratch a woman deeply enough, the old saying is you'll find a feminist. And it's something about meeting in groups. And in fact, knowing more about the issues, and the issues really were not making up the story that women are being cheated. There is a factual reality to it. The more informed they become, the more informed the group becomes, the more feminist it becomes. So you can start off with a very moderate to anti-even women's liberation group, and I can tell you the more it meets, the more it deals with the issues of the day, the more supportive it becomes.
My guest is Eleanor Smeal, who was the president of NOW from 1977 to 82, and she's written a new book titled Why and How Women Will Elect the Next President. Do you think that the Democratic Party takes the women's vote for granted or the feminist vote for granted?
Well, I think there's a tendency to do that because you think, well, if you're not Republican, you got no choice in this country but to be Democrat. However, I also believe that they don't really take it for granted, or they're worried to death it won't be big enough. And they're worried that they don't quite understand it enough. I frankly feel they have something to worry because the gender gap is not always there in every election. I call it in my book a blinking on and blinking off phenomena. It has the potential to be actualized or to occur at all times, but the campaign must trigger it. There must be elements to make the issues highly visible in a way that will polarize the vote. It just isn't going to happen automatically, and there is no, as I say in the book, women were not reborn Republican, Democrat, or yesterday. There's a natural cynicism, frankly, from women because they haven't been treated so well. There has been a lot of lip service, and so they're very jaundiced towards promises. So I think that the Democrats have a potential of capturing a very strong and powerful vote, but only, frankly, if they become credible and do address these issues in a real and deep way, and there's people see results. Nothing speaks as loud as actual accomplishments in doing.
As you said before, when a group gives a political endorsement to a candidate, they usually expect something in return. What does NOW expect from Mondale if he's elected?
Well, one, they hope that they expect him to be made stronger by their endorsement, let's put it that way. And they hope and expect that he will be strong in return on women's issues, that he will see that the constituency that's behind him is pro-women's rights, and that he will boost women's opportunities in a whole host of fields, not only the Equal Rights Amendment, which he has promised to do all he can to pass, but also that he maintains an atmosphere in which keeps abortion safe and legal, that he works on programs, for example, such as child care. I don't know if you realize that Mondale supported the first child care bill that ever got through Congress in 1971, only to have it vetoed by Nixon. And we hope that he will revive a program, improve upon it, and get it passed this time with his own signature. So essentially, all these are hopes and expectations, and I think how you judge an endorsing is really a person's record. If the person has done that and is inclined towards it, you have a lot greater chance of them doing it when they get in there. And so we always judge more by what they've done than what they say they'll do.
There's been a lot of speculation about who Mondale would choose if he won the Democratic primary for his running mate. And some of the speculation I've heard includes that he'd perhaps ask Jesse Jackson to be his vice presidential running mate, since Jackson has strong backing and is considered by many people to be the most charismatic person, most charismatic contender right now. Other speculation is that Mondale might ask a woman to be the vice presidential candidate on his ticket. Do you care to speculate what would happen?
Well, I hope that he does open up the whole process to women and blacks in a very significant and visible way. Now, clearly, there's only one position. Now, it is true that the person could be a black woman. It's also true it could be a black man or a white woman. But I hope that he opens up the vice presidential slot to a new constituency that they need to get elected, and frankly, that they need to show that they are, in fact, committed to furthering opportunities for more people. I also know, as you well know, that a president in shaping his administration has more than a vice president to choose. So I'm hoping that at the top, after this nomination, will be visible many black and female leaders who will give the atmosphere of a new constituency. And frankly, I view it as the have-nots. And there's many ways of doing it. And I don't think it has to be an either-or. I think it has to be a coalition of more people. At the same time, I think this nonsense that he's catering to special interests is just that, because labor represents 19 million workers, but almost every worker depends upon labor's wages being high enough so that the minimum wage is high. And you go on to all kinds of ethnic groups, not just blacks, but Italian Americans and ethnics of all kinds are dependent also upon increased opportunity for all people. I think that, frankly, what we need is, you talk about a return. I think what we need is a little more old-fashioned populism, which returns a lot more to people. And frankly, I think we've gotten a lot of an imbalance on runaway right now of benefits to a very small special interest of the rich.
Eleanor Smeal is my guest, the former national president of NOW and author of the new book, Why and How Women Will Elect the Next President. I know that a lot of women will be working hard to get out the women's vote during the primary and during the election. How are you going about doing that? What's the technique that you think will be most effective in mobilizing women as a women's bloc?
I think the first and most important thing, and again, one of the reasons I wrote the book, is people have to see what's at stake. And I think you organize blocks of votes these days by issues. I think they matter. I think, for example, every college-age young woman should know that if, in fact, Mr. Reagan is elected, she might lose her right to choice and abortion for the rest of her childbearing ages, because he'll have enough Supreme Court appointments to outlaw abortion, probably. We never know these things for sure, because you never know if somebody's going to resign at the court level. But there are five judges over the age of 74, and they are in the pro-choice block. So he has enough votes that he, chances of replacements that he could, because we're only a couple of votes away from it now, lead to an outlawing of abortion and a return to the conditions of the 60s where women actually die trying to get illegal abortions. I think they have a lot at stake. I think that women who want to have decent pay have a lot of at stake, because affirmative action is being destroyed. So I think that really one of the major jobs we have is to spreading the word exactly what the record of this administration is and what it means in four more years of it. I think it happens to be devastating. But I do feel in this day and age you do organize a lot around issues. So we'll be doing that. We also will be organizing around various constituencies of the gender gap. For example, there's no question that younger voters are more supportive of progressive policies than older voters on the average. Let's use averages. And yet they're underregistered. Under 30-year-olds, 18 to 30-year-olds are the largest block of the gender gap voters, yet only about 40% of them are registered even to vote. We have got to up that registration and up the turnout. They've got a lot of stake at this election. They're allowing the next generation to really mortgage their future. So essentially you do it by constituencies and you do it by issues.
A lot of people don't vote.
Absolutely.
How do you try to reach the people who traditionally don't turn out for an election?
Well, as I say, motivation is a big thing. Jesse Jackson's doing it like nobody else is with the blacks. I mean, he's putting it right where it's at, that each one of those blokes, those votes, is a power in and of itself, and that they're being discouraged. You know, the old saying is, people keeps on saying, your vote doesn't count. Well, we know one thing. If you don't vote, it surely won't count. And if you do vote, and enough people like you vote, it might just determine the election. So it doesn't cost you anything, and it's really expensive if you don't turn out. And when you have a president that's been elected by 27% of the electorate, and that's all Mr. Lagan is elected by, you can see what a small minority, if organized and voting, can do.
A couple of myths that have been popularly believed about women is that women vote for the better-looking candidate. And that women vote what their husbands vote.
Mm-hmm. Actually, this thing about us voting for the good-looking candidate, all through my graduate school in the 60s, now you had to listen to this. Oh, we would be swayed by anybody with looks, and if women got more powerful, Winston Churchill would never get elected. Actually, there's far more evidence now that men vote according to appearances than women do. You know, and it really makes a lot of common sense because, you know, for years, psychologists have asked men if choosing a mate is look how important looks are, and they've asked the same question to women. Women have always listed looks as one of the lesser important factors. Well, men have always had it as a higher factor. Men, I think, because they have been led to believe that they have more power, are more swayed by appearances. Women, I think, because they're much more vulnerable, want to know what the person's education is, want to know, can this person make a living? The heck with looks, we got to eat, right? We tend to be more practical. So anyway, it's a myth. There's no data to substantiate it right now. You know, a movie star is being supported by men, not the woman's vote.
What about the idea that women vote the same as their husbands do? And I think a lot of people who've gone door-to-door canvassing would frequently knock on a door where it's 3 o'clock, the woman of the house is home, the husband's not, and she says, well, I don't know, come back later when my husband's here.
Sure. Yeah, that day's gone and going. As a matter of fact, most people doing canvassing no longer do it in person because almost no one's home. most polling now is done by telephones. And an awful lot, if you're going to get a balanced sample, it has to be done in the evenings or the supper hours, because do you realize only about 15% of the population's home during the day? Females just simply are doing different things. So that's one of the major changes. Another major change is that they freely give their opinion much more now, and they differ frequently with the men. That's what the gender gap's all about. You now have a significant portion of women voting differently than men do.
Political action committees, or PACs, are very controversial within politics now. They're groups that can... Well, why don't you describe what PACs are?
Well, PAC is a group that under the Federal Election Commission or under various state election agencies can contribute to candidates. And essentially, you can only now do it two different ways. Either an individual gives directly or a conglomeration of individuals gives through a PAC. But corporations can't give directly. They must form a PAC. And organizations that are nonprofits can't do it directly. They must do it through a PAC.
One of the controversial uses of PACs have been to spend the money to defeat a candidate, to target a candidate for defeat. What do you think the ethics of PACs should be? Because I think that there is now has a PAC, doesn't it?
Yeah, we have several. We have 81.
81 PACs?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we have two at the nationwide, one at the federal level, one at the state legislative level, but then a lot of local chapters and state organizations have PACs for their states and local level offices.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think the ethics of PACs should be?
Well, I think that they should, I always believe in truth in advertising. I think you should try to support those things that you say you're going to support so that your donors have an accurate perception of what you're going to do. I feel that, frankly, the discussion around PACs frequently misses the point. What they're worried about is that they're worried about the vested interest, the business interest, the corporate interest taking over the process by dominating it money-wise. And there's no question that the largest portion of PACs are corporate PACs, overwhelming. But the progressive groups which attack PACs really are attacking the giving of contributors to nonprofit organization PACs, which really are representing people, not small vested interests. I mean, they're representing really huge constituencies, whereas they're not just representing Exxon Oil, they're representing, you know, all the people in a community who are for tougher water pollution control or something like that. I feel that there are two different animals, really. People who get together to form a PAC just to further their own business interests are really the old-fashioned special interests. The people who band together to outlaw handgun control, they themselves are not going to profit by this, except if they don't get shot, you know. But they personally gain nothing by their own pocketbook. They're doing it for what they believe is a common good. And I think that that kind of association is in the, I don't know what you do unless you let a few millionaires dominate the whole process.
Well, there also are conservative PACs that are doing what they believe in, such as, for instance, trying to defeat candidates with a pro-choice.
Right-to-life PACs, there's all kinds of, for every PAC on one side of the spectrum, there's usually one on the other side. But as long as they're not, see, what I fear in the whole process is not really the little people getting together and trying to make some of their issues heard. I fear far more the dominance of large wealth and corporate wealth in the process. So that, for example, in the United States Senate right now, a few millionaires, 20-some millionaires now, sit in the seats. I mean, really, in our own state here in Pennsylvania, I'm a Pennsylvanian, Mr. Hines is virtually, you know, he might say that he raises money through a large spectrum, but the truth of the matter is his own pocket is endless. And right now under the current PAC laws, an individual can give unlimited amounts to their own campaign. But another person running that does not have limitless money can only collect contributions at the size of $1,000 apiece or from PACs up to $5,000. So this is how I put it. Now has 250,000 members. And all 250,000 members can only give into a federal race a total of $5,000. But one millionaire running themselves can put into that race $11 million, $10 million, $1 million, no limits. Well, what you've done is you created rules that make it so easy for a very wealthy person to buy the seat and very difficult for average income people to raise the kind of money necessary. Because when you're trying to raise money, and that's what PACs have to do, that, you know, nonprofit PACs or small PACs, at $1,000 a crack, you need a lot of rich people to give. Now, to me, the whole thing's in balance. The rules favor the wealthy, and that is why, in fact, money has become the major issue of the elections.
Do you think that it should be acceptable for a PAC to use its money to target somebody for defeat? So, in other words, instead of the money supporting somebody, the money is going to take out commercials against the other person or to circulate literature against the other person.
Sure.
You think
I
that
do.
Should be acceptable?
Well, absolutely. And I think that NCPAC, which is the National Conservative PAC, is one of the largest forerunners on it. They don't agree with me on anything. They're very, very conservative. I'm obviously not. But I see no difference in, for example, NCMAC would want to defeat anybody that opposed Mr. Helms, who's the senator running for re-election in North Carolina. He's a reactionary conservative who they would support. Feminists would like to defeat Mr. Helms because basically he's the leader on the floor against women's rights measures. Well, you tell me what difference does it make if you are a PAC working to defeat somebody or working to elect somebody. It really depends on what side of the fence you are, and both positions frequently are necessary so that your viewpoint has more power or clout. I think that's perfectly permissible, and I know that they have a bad name. You know, the negative, they call it negative politics. Well, isn't it right for someone to say, hey, you know, this guy is a leading opponent of us and we'd like to defeat him because as long as he sits there, we're going to go backwards, whatever the viewpoint is. To me, it's a legitimate form of campaigning.
I'd like to open up the telephones and invite our listeners to call with any questions or comments. My guest is Eleanor Smeal, and she was the former national president of NOW, and she's the author of the new book, Why and How Women Will Elect the Next President. If you have any questions, our number is 923-2774 at area code 215. The number again, 923 2774. Let's talk a little bit about now, before we get to some of our phone calls. There's been a lot of very intense internal disputes within NOW. Do you think that that's a kind of a dirty secret that people in NOW don't want other people to know? I remember, like, in the 1975 NOW presidential election, for instance, there was very intense quarreling within the organization, mm-hmm. much as there is with any political mm-hmm. party at convention time.
Yeah, we've never tried to hide it, actually. It's been all over the front pages whenever we – I think that we get an awful large share of publicity on that kind of stuff. And in 1975, when we had an internal struggle, goodness, it was front pages of newspapers. So we were obviously weren't hiding it. And I don't think we seek to. I do feel, though, that anybody that accentuates that is distorting the reality, because a lot of times when we have had internal disputes over who should be the next leader, it's been interpreted to mean that the organization is divided on an issue. And, for example, the 75 struggle didn't have anything to do with gay rights, but it was interpreted by the media frequently that it was a pro and anti-gay rights vote, which it wasn't. It had a lot to do with administrative organization and how the organization was going to be, in fact, structured and run. So, essentially, I think that sometimes people get the interpretation that if it's a highly contested election, and ours frequently are, that the group might disagree on fundamental issues. Actually, NOW is very united on fundamental issues.
Wasn't there a disagreement, though, about whether lesbian rights should be officially endorsed as part of the platform?
Not since I've been active at the national level, and I've been active at the national level since 73. The decision on gay rights was made in 71, and it never was an issue in 75. It was interpreted to be the issue. It didn't have a thing to do with it. In fact, there were gay people supporting both tickets. It was sort of one of the difficult things for a small organization, really, vis-a-vis the general public, is to make their elections understandable. Because basically, you know, who's the president of NOW? And the election is only before the public in that short period of time right before an election. And so people are trying to interpret what does this mean for the public, and they try to take shortcuts. Most of the election disputes that I know of in my own organization, and frankly that I know of in other organizations, have much more to do with who and what crowd is going to run the show and how they're going to run it, rather than the basic issues of our day. And the basic issues of the day, NOW has been fortunate, really, to have really reached a consensus before they ever moved on. And they're really at a consensus stage on most of the major issues that they've taken.
Do you think that NOW was initially utopian or was expected to be utopian? There was a feeling that, well, men have developed all these political crises, but if women ran the world, it would mm-hmm. be different. And here was a national group of women that was having the same kind of political infighting that male-dominated groups traditionally had. Were women surprised that was going to happen to women, too?
I don't know. I mean, I can honestly say I wasn't. And I don't know how other people feel. I think that it's ridiculous to think that women are not going to have disagreements. If they're not, they can't obviously feel too strongly about things, and we obviously feel as strongly as men. I think that one of the keystones of the feminist movement is that women, in fact, are people, that like all other people, namely their male counterparts, we feel strongly about matters. We work hard. We play hard. In fact, we compete with each other. We just never were given the opportunity to do so. And I don't think the feminist movement was very surprised by it. It would be easier if everything was utopian and there was peace on earth in every category, and goodness knows most of us would prefer it more. In fact, I think that women don't enjoy political fighting as much as men. We've been calculated to not like fights. In other words, we tend to back off of them. I think they're more painful for us. Because other people think that they're not as natural, although they, goodness knows, are, we tend to take them more deeply, and I think suffer more as a result of it. I don't think you find among females as many so-called happy warriors. We don't like it. We don't think it would be nicer if, in fact, there was not arguing. So we tend to be very critical of ourselves when that occurs. And in some ways, I think that it stultifies growth. I really feel that discussion, and sometimes heated discussion, is necessary to develop ideas. Because if you are bored with an idea or blah on an idea or you don't give a doggone or you doze off, well, indeed, consensus is easier to reach. But when ideas are in the formation stages and people are excited about them and they're thinking about them and they're grappling with them, well, that's when you have passions run deeper, and I think it shows growth.
Okay, well, let's take our first phone call. My guest is Eleanor Smeal, who is the president of NOW, the National Organization for Women, from 1977 to 1982. And she's the author of the new book, Why and How Women Will Elect the Next President. Our number, if you have any questions, is 923-2774. You should put these headphones on.
Oh, yeah.
Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Me?
Yes.
I was wondering, where is the list of laws by state that discriminate against women? Remember when Mr. Reagan fired that person in Washington? She supposedly had worked up a whole list, computerized and all, of the various discriminatory laws by state.
She did. And
But we never got the report on it. We never found out about it. I know Pennsylvania has, we have the ERA in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Well, actually, I have seen her report.
Oh,
and many
have?
People have, yes. Uh-huh. And
how can you get it?
Well, I don't know if the government is still distributing it, but I'm sure you could get it from NOW.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello?
Go ahead.
I want to ask Eleanor Smeal a question or two. Ms. Smeal, if that's the proper Ms. Ms. M.S.?
Ms. is fine.
Ms.? Okay. You cited, in speaking of the abortion question, that we didn't want to revert to the 60s when mothers died because of incompetent abortions. And you would say, maintaining the current law, you know, a proper function of the government to protect those lives from exposure to hairdressers or whatever, up back alleys, etc. Do you think there is any question or merit to raising the question of the other life involved in an abortion?
You know, most women face this question somewhere along in their pregnancy. But when you're talking about, remember, the vast, vast, vast majority of abortions occur at the time when there is no independent life. I mean,
no independent life.
But they cannot. I mean, you're talking about something that is so small and ill-defined that sometimes when the abortion is done, they're not quite sure that it was an abortion. I mean, you're really talking about protoplasm at that stage. I mean, it really depends on what stage you're talking about. It depends on the need for the abortion. It depends. See, I could say, well, we'll set up one rule. And whatever that rule is, I can guarantee you, human beings being what they are, there'll be exceptions. For example, a tubal pregnancy could have indeed be quite far along before it's discovered. And it almost always results, I think it always results, as a matter of fact, in the death of the mother if continued. Well, for the mother not to have an abortion would be suicide.
But, of course, now, this is indirect abortion and has always been allowed, for instance, in the Catholic Church.
I'm not sure that
indirect
is,
abortion, you can look in any Catholic.
This is not an indirect abortion. It would be something that would have to be, it's not aborted naturally. It's something that would have to be an induced abortion. What I'm trying to say is whatever you would set up, somebody else might disagree with you. For example, what about an 11-year-old who carrying it to term would absolutely destroy her life and it's unnecessary, it's a victim of rape or incest? Or a woman who's unhealthy, or a woman who can't even afford the last couple children, or whatever the case is. Those, we believe, have to be individual decisions, and that really you have to look at this as an ultimately the final resort in birth control.
I want to thank you for your call. Our number, if you have any questions, is 923-2774. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to make one comment about the ERA. I think this early squabbling in the women's movement, and now because it was the largest women's organization, I think was primarily responsible for it, lost us the ERA, because when the momentum for the amendment was there, it was lost because of all the squabbling.
Well, that's not the historical truth.
Well, that's how
when the squabbling became in now, which was post the stalling of the ERA. The ERA really stalls around 1972-73 historically. At that time, the women's movement was not only unified, but frankly was very small in the process, and other major groups were in the leadership of it, for example, the League of Women Voters, the BPW, et cetera. Now, the real reason the ERA stalls is because the opposition to it, those who profit from sex discrimination, were able to lock it up in states where it's very easy for a handful of people to control. They're in gerrymandered states and gerrymandered districts. And so we, who were the majority of the people, could not get at the leadership because, in fact, they were from districts that were totally controlled by a handful of people. And, I mean, if you... I wish that the women's movement would have been powerful enough. The truth of the matter is our opponents, those who would like to keep sex discrimination, were more powerful.
What if Ronald Reagan is reelected? What does that say about women?
Well, it depends on who runs against him, what kind of campaign he runs, et cetera. For example, he was elected in 80. I don't think it said anything about women because I do believe Mr. Carter was defeated, not Mr. Reagan elected.
Thank you for your call. Our number for your questions is 923-2774. Since the ERA failed, do you think that the movement to get a vote again will be as strong as it was, or do you think that organized women's groups are putting their attention in other places for the time being?
Well, for the time being, they are, because they feel the political climate is so disastrous for women, it's very hard to move forward. You're trying to protect what you have. But in the long run, the campaign will be bigger than we can even imagine in 82. As it was, 82 was much bigger than we could have mustered in 72, because the women's movement had grown so much over that period of time. When it finally goes over the top, it will be exceedingly bigger.
Let's take our next phone call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Oh, hello. What is NOW doing to reach captive audiences like those in universities, colleges, churches, synagogues, unions? I've had the unpleasant experience of speaking to people in those areas, and they are so strong for Reagan. I find it impossible to believe the story that's coming out that Reagan is going to win and going to win big.
Well, in the first place, the polls don't show he's going to win big yet. And in fact, they show a very close race and that he's very vulnerable. Actually, all kinds of groups, including NOW, are organizing in many different places. I speak, for example, frequently to all different kinds of groups, not only women's groups, but college campuses, business groups, a whole variety of people, but so do a lot of people do that. We're reaching out constantly and organizing constantly.
Well, may I ask you this question? You are speaking to an audience that is fairly knowledgeable, quite knowledgeable now. Will you be speaking on other radio stations where you're going to find a different approach to this coming campaign?
I've been speaking today on, I don't know how many stations, I guess my 9 or 10.
In Philadelphia?
Interviews, yeah. I did 9 or 10, I think. Someone just told me that many. Anyway, we're constantly reaching out to different audiences. We don't want to talk to limited numbers. We want to talk to a whole variety of people. But frankly, in my opinion, you can't exclude any group. Frequently, those people who are the most educated and the most informed don't vote enough because they feel that's useless, or they don't think they're going to win, or maybe it's beneath them, or whatever the attitude. We have to motivate people to take part no matter what their status or level of information.
Thank you very much for your call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon, and good afternoon to your guests. First of all, I'd like to make a comment about so many men being so interested in a negative point of view about abortion. And I realize that the suicide rate changes every year, but I still don't think that murder at the hands of men, the suicide rate, I find that men still top the list.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Ms. Neal, didn't you make a comment, I think it was last year, a year before last, that one of the mistakes in the women's movement was not seriously forming a coalition with poor and minority women?
I don't know what you're referring to. I think that we've made many, many attempts over the years for such a coalition continuously to.
I thought it was a comment that you made after the ERA bill was ratified.
No, I didn't make that comment. Well, I don't feel that's the truth either.
Whoever said it, they happened to express my sentiments.
Well, you should know a little bit about the voting patterns. Almost, I think every black legislator who voted on this amendment voted yes. We had tremendous support from the minority community. The reason we lost was not because of lack of black support. It's because blacks do not have ample representation to their numbers in the South. The South is gerrymandered, so the blacks don't have enough seats. In fact, in Florida, for example, a Senate that we always lost in, there were no black senators. The first black senator was elected in November of 82. When Jesse Jackson says that one of the ways the ERA will pass is by more blacks registering voting and getting more representation in the South, he knows what he's talking about.
Thank you very much for your call. That's all the phone calls we're going to have time for today. My guest is Eleanor Smeal, former national president of NOW, the National Organization for Women, and author of the new book, Why and How Women Will Elect the Next President. At what point in your life did you become a feminist?
Gee, I don't even know. If I had known I was going to do so much on this subject, I would have taken note. But I really don't know. I think it was over a period of time. When I became active, and now it was 1970, but I'd already been interested in women's rights before that.
What had introduced you to it?
Well, I think it's the whole process of experiencing discrimination all the way through. And finally getting a name for it. I don't know when I first heard the feminist name, but sometime in the 60s, I suppose, in my 20s. And it's really a life process. I think that's the reason why it's not a fad. It's not going to come and go. It's something that's with you. If you're a woman and you become aware of how, in fact, you have been cheated because of your sex, I don't think it's something that you can just ignore or walk away from.
You've been in NOW since its beginnings, haven't you?
Well, not. It actually began in 67. When I became a member in 1970, we had about 3,000 members.
The organization has grown a lot. Its political power has grown a lot. What would you like to see NOW become?
Well, I, of course, would like to see it have 1 million members and much stronger so that we can actually help to find or to elect many more women. I would love for our fundamental goal of equal rights for women under the law to pass, and for us to be really strong enough that we could be innovative in solutions again. Right now, we're forced to sort of defend the gains of the past instead of looking forward to new solutions for the future. And I hope that we get on with it and get to the point that we really are able to cut new ground to improve the quality of life for people.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
Good being here.
Eleanor Smeal has been my guest, and she was the president of the National Organization for Women from 1977 to 82. She's written a new book about the gender gap. It's called Why and How Women Will Elect the Next President. And it's published by Harper. The title again, Why and How Women Will Elect the Next President.